However, whenever, and possibly even if ever, those are questions confronting Parliament throughout this week as the United Kingdom moves ever closer to March 29th, 2019, the scheduled date for Brexit, when the country will exit from membership in the European Union. Welcome to Scholarly Publishing Through the Brexit Lens, a special presentation of the London Book Fair. I'm Christopher Keneally for Copyright Clearance Center, and thank you for joining us here in Olympia Hall. Just 4 miles away, MPs at Westminster are preparing right now to vote this evening, Tuesday, on Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit deal. Only last night, May was in Strasbourg, refining still further the terms of Britain's leave-taking. The first time she presented a proposed deal, in January, May suffered an historic defeat, losing by 230 votes. No one knows whether she has since made enough changes to persuade enough MPs to vote her way this time. If the nature and even the timing of Brexit remain unclear, one may still confidently predict that Brexit will mean important changes for the UK's scholarly publishing community. For the researchers whose contributions drive content into society journals and high impact factor publications alike, Brexit will rewrite rules governing partnerships with European colleagues, as well as access to resources available for research. For publishers, shifts in long-established editorial and business practices also raise questions that will require ample patience for risk and uncertainty over the short and medium term. As publishers, what challenges should you prepare for? What opportunities may possibly lie ahead? What might Brexit mean to the transition to open access? My panel will explore the many possible directions Brexit may lead publishing in 2019 and afterward. And I'd like to introduce them now. Starting from my left at the far end is Tim Britton. Tim, welcome. Tim Britton is the former managing director of the Open Research Group at Springer Nature, where he had responsibility for the open research portfolio across Springer Nature, which includes BMC, Springer Open, the open access journals from Nature Research, and many others. He was previously head of strategy and transformation for PwC's Global Data Research and Insight Center, R21. I want to then welcome to the panel Hugh Logue. Hugh, welcome. Hugh Logue is the director and lead analyst for legal and regulatory solutions at Outsell, a research and advisory firm that tracks market performance and trends in the data and information industry. His clients include major publishers, software companies, and legal services providers. And you should know that Hugh was called to the Bar of England and Wales in 2007. To my right, joining us today from Hanover in Germany, is Petra Labriga. Petra, welcome. Petra Labriga works as a management consultant and project manager at TIB Hanover, the German National Library of Science and Technology. There, she assists leaders and specialist teams during change processes regarding TIB's service offerings, such as content delivery and open access transformation. So she's a sort of a double agent here. She's both non-UK and a client, as well as an observer of the scene. But she's also worked in the publishing world at various roles at content aggregators, Infotrieve, and in the private sector, and the British Library as well. And then finally, on the far end here to my right is Simon Ross. Simon, welcome. Simon Ross joined Manchester University Press as chief executive in 2016 after nearly 10 years with Cambridge University Press as managing director of journals and deputy managing director of the academic group, spending the last 4 years based in New York. He is a past chairman of ALPSP and has held senior editorial and management positions at Sage Publications, Pearson Education, and the Times Publishing Group. And so a panel well qualified to meet the challenge here at this very last minute of asking or responding to the question I will ask, which is, what next? And Hugh Logue, for Outsell, you have been following the Brexit drama, as it is, for a number of years now. And tell us, let's get right to the chase. Has there been any damage done, or has it all been a lot of hot air so far, and hot air mostly over at Westminster?
I think, well, we're now at this point where it's been 3 years since the referendum. It's 2 years since the negotiations began, and over 2 months since the supposed deal was agreed. And in that time, there has been already some damage done. Fundamentally, straight off the currency exchange rates, the pound became significantly weaker against the dollar and the yen and the euro. So for scientific academic institutions, already they when they're buying equipment and consumables, those are already 20% more expensive. Now, their funding is fixed on fixed funds, so that money has to come from somewhere. Scholarly publishing and printing public products are the first in line, quite often, to be cut. It's an easy cut to make for them, rather than making people unemployed or closing down departments. So we've seen it from that point of view, that there's been some impact already. In terms of scientific laboratories, we've seen anecdotally that lead scientists that are British have been dropped from projects because their likelihood of getting renewed funding is diminished because of the uncertainty of Brexit. And that has knock-on consequences, again, for the whole industry. And if the scientific industry struggles, well, the publishing industry feeds off that, and therefore there's a knock-on effect. So I think at the moment, there's the most significant consequences have purely come from the currency exchange rate and lower value of the pound. But we'll see what comes in terms of immigration. We've seen potential there, depending how the agreement goes. Around 1 in 6 researchers are from outside of the UK. So we'll see how that goes from there on.
Now, the lower pound, though, has driven some bargain hunting by people from the United States and elsewhere when it comes to acquisitions. Is that true?
Yeah. I've certainly worked with a few clients in acquiring UK-based publishers who primarily earn in dollars. So if they're based in London or elsewhere in the UK, but they generate revenue in South America or elsewhere in the United States, then those were brilliant deals for the publishers for US publishers to acquire. And in many cases, they were considering acquiring these businesses anyway. They just hadn't got very far with it. And as soon as the currencies changed, that just changed the whole playing field. And actually, some of the prices of these companies then went up a little bit because they were competing with each other to acquire them. So I had a few clients who were getting advice on that front.
Yeah. One of the worries that people had, even in the run-up to the referendum vote and since then, has been that the companies based in the UK may want to relocate for various advantages around staff and trade. Has that happened in publishing? Have we seen a lot of relocations of the kind that we may expect to see in financial?
Well, the digital single market is part of the EU, and if there's no single market for computer games and e-books or TV broadcasting, then that makes it very hard because they have to be based in the EU. So we've already seen Sony, Viacom, even the BBC are looking to locate a base in the EU. So, yes, we have seen some companies, particularly broadcasting companies, relocate into the EU. We're hearing of others who are preparing for that as well. I think there's a concern that if you make too much of a fanfare, that you're relocating, that you're making a political statement. So quite often these things are happening with shell companies through accountancy firms, and you're not going to hear about it in the press unless you have a particularly activist CEO or president who wants to make it clear that they're relocating because of Brexit.
All right. Well, Simon Ross, you're there in Manchester. You can't very well relocate. You can't pick up the city and move. So no. you're faced with dealing with Brexit as it happens, when it happens, if it happens. Talk about the importance of the university to Manchester and to the research and the importance of the research that goes on there.
Yeah, so obviously the Manchester University Press is part of its home institution is the university. The university is the largest university in the UK with over 40,000 students, and it's very woven into the fabric of the city, and many of its cultural and outreach activities are engaged with the council and other institutions within the city. It's also one of the top three employers of the city. So in terms of the impact to the university, which is around about £1 billion enterprise, they're forecasting a hit from Brexit and other factors of between 100 and 300 million every year, with the downturn in foreign student income mainly, with having to fund things like Plan S, and with the general negative, I think, attitude from this government towards higher education, but more importantly, a big review about to be announced about post-18 education and how the resources for that are going to be allocated. And the indications are that fees are not going to go up, they'll go down, which means that we'll have less money to fund all sorts of activities within a university. And in terms of the research side, I think there's a general worry about the culture of collaboration, which seems to be disrupted, where the research funds are going to come from. And in fact, the very nature of research funding, at the moment, in a very simplistic term, money from foreign students basically covers the costs of hosting the research that's done within in the institution, which although it's funded, it's not fully funded, so there's not a full cost recovery from the grants. So this additional money that comes from foreign students makes up that difference. Now this means that the university is now going to become more expensive to do research because they're going to have full cost recovery for all research activity. And that means that we may become a less attractive place to win research funds. And of course, this has a knock-on effect for publishing, because the nature of what is being funded, if it is funded to produce the research to be published, will change. And I think a last point to make about the particular nature of cost recovery in our university is that we're also looking at ways of working closer with industry and having a more realistic expectation about what the nature of the research is and how it should be funded, and also to make it more translatable back into first the local economy but the national economy and wider.
Right, and the timeline as it stands at least has given you 2 years nearly to look ahead and to do some planning and to make some adjustments. What has that act of evaluation brought to light that you might not otherwise have known?
Well, if I talk specifically about the university press, it's made us focus very closely on the physical supply chain that we require to get our books to market. So that has actually forced us to look at something that most publishers are not that interested in. I mean, they're interested in getting the books to market, but they're not really interested in really about every point at which it happens. They rely on their partnerships, they rely on their expertise of their distributors and so on. So we've had to ask our partners about what is their strategy, what are their mitigating activities to deal with whatever fallout we have from Brexit. They've been very responsive. We also, I think, in looking at that supply chain, looked at alternatives to supply our books to market and found there are actually some efficiencies that can be made within the existing framework. And I think with the strategies we're putting in place, that also mitigates risks against other activities that may or may not be Brexit related. So it's actually had a perverse positive effect in that respect. And the weak pound is great. Long live the weak pound, because most of our business is exported. So it's not all bad news.
Well, we will talk actually about some more of the upside in just a moment. But books, as much as they are digital artifacts today and any other type of publishing, especially books, though, remain physical objects. So you're going to need to be shipping them across borders. You're going to need paper imported. Those are going to be real challenges. If the UK returns to the WTO rules, can you tell us what you've learned as to how that will affect the physical product?
Well, as all the advice is saying that the WTO rules will not impact the rate at which taxes apply. It's a zero-rated. Books are zero-rated. So the actual rates will not change. What may change are extra levies and administration around importing and exporting. So there may be extra costs, and there may be delays around that as well. So there are risks there, but they're not actually in the actual taxation rate, which is favourable for the print product.
And administrative costs, those are possibly to rise?
Hard to assess. At the moment, we're trying to avoid any immediate problems by printing and holding stock early, making sure that we have stock in the locations where we need it, and making sure that we have adequate warehouse space. But we do know that printers are buying, stockpiling paper, but they can only stockpile a certain amount, partly because a lot of the paper resources and manufacturing around paper is being diverted to make Amazon boxes. So there's a potential shortage, particularly with the rise of the interest in replacing plastic packaging. So this is something that you probably would not have foreseen 6 months ago even, but there may well be paper shortages in the UK for printing in the short term. So, I mean, lots of publishers are thinking about that, the very physical supply chain issues, which editorial types like myself probably didn't get involved with until they needed to. That's the kind of thing we're dealing with.
And Tim Britton, I want to turn to you because your recent position at Simon Nature, at Springer Nature, led you to look closely at open access policies here in the UK, but also across Europe and in many other countries too. The exit of Britain from the European Union is going to mean a change in some of the open access policies or the compliance for them?
I don't think it will, actually. I think, don't get me wrong, I think all of the issues that we've been discussing already are around how Brexit will affect the physical running of a business, and absolutely it will. So you're talking about supply, you're talking about employment issues, you're talking about attracting talent, can people work here, all of that stuff, for sure it applies. But when it comes down to the actual policies that are applied, I think the comment that was just made a moment ago about the increased pressure on budgets will have an impact, but it's if because, of course, it's Plan S that's got the bigger European impact on open access publishing at the moment rather than Brexit per se. If that follows through, a really interesting report out from Clarivate last week. If you haven't read it, I recommend it. I think they were saying in the region of 140, 150 million was the funding gap if you run through everything that should be funded away by the current funders that have signed up to Plan S. More money would have to be found, just as we've just heard, at the same time when there's consummate pressure on funding more generally. So I think counterintuitively, Brexit won't have a particularly big impact on the policy. It may actually have an impact on how fast that policy can move, because you've got a big move towards open access at the same time where funds are restricting, which might mean it becomes harder.
Right. And when it comes to open access and publishing generally, of course, borders are less and less important all the time, and they have been for many years. And the research that's done is in certain fields or in certain regions. And so even without the political framework of the EU, the British researchers, British publishers will still be working with the same people they had before.
That's true. I think there are undoubtedly issues around how research teams are put together, and we've already heard many examples of UK institutions not potentially being on bid lists for projects when hitherto they would have been. So I do think there are very real issues for the community in sourcing of research funding. But in terms of how that is then published, I don't think it will have the same impact. As you say, publishing is by and large a global enterprise. I'm not saying all organisations are global, but in its nature it is global. The practices are global, and it won't change the custom practice of the publishing process per se. What may be the issue is if you are in a discipline or an area which does tend to be, is more geographically focused, then of course it could have an impact if you haven't got the same access to European funding in particular that you previously did.
Right. And for publishers, access to labour is important as access to funds. Or
that's certainly a big one.
So talk about the potential impact there if the EU nationals who are located today and working for, located here in Britain, working for publishers, UK-based publishers, if for some reason they're no longer able to work here. What's that going to mean?
Yeah, I think, I mean, London is obviously a major hub for publishing, and so forgive me, colleagues, it's not just London, but indeed Manchester, Glasgow, many other cities, if I've forgotten them, I mean you too. We're all chasing the same talent pool, and certainly from a personal experience, within Springer Nature, we're employing many European nationals. And whilst one would like to think that there are some arrangements were made, and so that the freedom of necessary movement of labour and students would remain possible, I actually think at this stage it's a psychological thing. I mean, we've had, you know, people are just nervous. If you've built a family here, if you've built a home here, but you don't actually have theoretical rights within the next 2 or 3 weeks to live here, you're going to ask yourself questions. So the people that were thinking themselves that are currently getting their PhD coming out of Berlin or Paris or Madrid or wherever they are they going to go to London? Of course they're not. Of course they're not. And that is the talent pool that we're competing with. At Springer Nature, we 2 or 3 years back now set up a hub in Berlin. It wasn't a direct response to the Brexit situation. What it was actually is we needed another hub that had a great scientific community with a great PhD programs where we had access to this talent. But what we found as a side effect from that is actually that it gave people some reassurance that, you know, we had almost like a safe harbour or a safe home for people. And that's just one example of one publishing house. And I think those decisions that are made all over the place, all of the time, I think it's that psychological effect, which it is impossible to measure, will have a far bigger impact than any of the actual policies or rules that come through.
I think it's a really important point, because we're emphasizing in this discussion the business considerations, the research considerations, but you're pointing to the emotional considerations here.
For sure. It's let's be honest. London is not as attractive a place as it was 2 years ago. After tonight, it may become less attractive still. Who knows? I think that there are ways around that. And I think, as you know, we are all from organisations with a very, very long heritage and working and embedded within a community which is international and global to its very core. And I'm sure we will find ways around that. And I'm sure that collaborations will continue. But, you know, on a very personal level, as I've said, if I was coming out of Berlin in September, having just finished my postdoc, would I move to London? Nah. Hmm.
Well, Petra Labriga, we will talk about your professional concerns on this issue. But what Tim has just been talking about, the personal concerns, the emotional concerns, you feel that as well.
Yeah, I'm so emotional about this. Having started my professional life working for the British Council, I mean, I did a British Library job for them at the time, but I mean, our job then in the 90s was to sell Cool Britannia. And I think we did a good job in Germany doing that. And I think now we are far away from that. So I absolutely support what you're saying. I think that foreigners are probably not feeling very welcome over here at the moment. So I would support what you said. If you've just done your PhD, would you go to London? I mean, London is still a lovely place, and it's very international. And I'm sure London didn't vote for Leave, you know. But, you know, all of that considered, I think you're right, absolutely.
Yeah. And apart from the work you've done here, you have family here, friends here.
Yeah.
How does it feel to be looking on from Hanover, Germany at the goings-on in Westminster?
Yeah, it's very weird. I think that You know, we have a saying in German, if you do something without actually having a need to do that, it's just absolutely illogical for us that this is happening for the majority, I think, of all the Europeans. I think we just don't get it. I mean, yes, we've heard all about it. I think we're very tired. I think the Brits are very tired. You don't want to hear anything about it anymore. And I think the rest of Europe is very tired too. So however this ends, I mean, I'm wearing black today. I'm in mourning if this is happening. But I think we're all happy once it's over. So that's the emotional thing. And yes, we feel it's divisive. I think that's what's so hard to accept.
Right. Well, let's talk about the professional piece of this. Your work is at TIB in Hanover, which is the largest research library in Germany. And how will whatever Brexit is, and this is where we kind of have to speculate.
We
more,
don't know that. Yeah.
But how would you expect it will complicate your work in the exchange of information and everything else that goes on, collaboration with the UK?
Well, I checked. So the people who do our purchasing, they expect more work to come in because of the customs situation. So we need, I think you talked about this. We need to deal with that. So it's going to be more expensive. So obviously our budget is not, you know, expanding. It's the other way around. So maybe because of that, we will only be able to buy less. I don't know that. But that's also maybe a point for us to think about paper. You know, maybe we want to stop certain paper journals and think about moving towards the e-journal. We do that anyway, but that might be another reason to do the swap there, because obviously if it's electronic, it's so much easier to deal with. Mm-hmm. We think. I mean, that's what I heard from my colleagues.
Well, at the library there, you're focused on research, and you have attended a number of recent conferences that are European, pan-European conferences. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing a change in mood? Are you seeing a change in the way that people are interacting with their UK colleagues?
No, I think we're very fond of our UK colleagues, but I think what it will happen, I think my colleagues here said it already, is that obviously the UK will lose that access to the projects. And I probably have to explain that the TIB is not only a technical library, we're also the University Library of Hanover, so of the university there. And at the same time, we're part of the Leibniz Society, which is one of the four big scientific societies. And we couldn't do anything much without European funding. I mean, so many projects we do, my colleagues who are scientists, they'll go for funding. So I just think it'll be very tough for the UK universities and for all the scientific people here to lose that funding. So I don't know if that money comes back to you in some other way, but I doubt it. So. Mm-hmm.
Now, if the UK were to leave, and we try to look at the bright side of some of this, that may mean greater access to funds. You were just speaking about those funds for European nationals who might otherwise have lost in a competition against those UK colleagues. Is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking of one thing. The weaker pound was something else that you mentioned earlier. So it'll make it nice for me to come over. It'll be cheaper for me, but that's a really bad thing to say. But we could also buy more as a library, so that would be another thing that could be positive. But I think overall, I think with Brexit, once it's over and once the UK is leaving, I don't know, or would be leaving, I think we can concentrate on the remaining Europe, you know, on what's there, on what we want to build, and just do something productive. I think the whole Brexit thing is just a waste of time for everybody. So, you know, once it's over, I hope that we can concentrate on that.
Well, Hugh Logue, is it possible that we can overstate some of these concerns as well, particularly when it comes to the potential increase in bureaucracy? Are there companies that are trying to capitalize on that concern and to address it?
Well, I mean, I don't know about if when we leave the EU, whether we leave with a deal or without a deal. I mean, the government's own figures say that you know, the if no deal happens, you know, we'll be down by about 9%. If we leave with a deal, we'll be down by about 3% over 15 years. So it's negative both ways. And the OECD say the same thing. If we, even with Theresa May's deal, we'll be going into a recession this year or next year. without a deal, it would be even worse. And they don't even haven't factored in the border controls and the infrastructure around the borders. So there's no upside, really, as far as I can see, to Brexit. There are perhaps from very niche companies that might be benefiting from that. So at Outsell, I normally cover the regulatory and legal side of publishing, and as well as regulatory affairs. And there are a couple of software companies that have designed software that can scan through using AI, can scan through your contracts to identify clauses in your contract that might be in danger from Brexit and will need renegotiated. So there's a few legal publishers that are doing well, legal software providers that are doing well. But I mean, these are tiny, small examples. And I think overall, you know, especially in scholarly publishing, where we're going to lose about 500 to a billion a year in funding from the EU, that just can't be made up. And if it, even when the national government tries to make that up, they're going to be biased in their political ways. They're going to meddle with it in the ways that the EU doesn't do. So if the party in government is popular in the south, well, then the south of England is likely to benefit from such funding. And it's difficult to that inevitably happens in these situations. And Europe has always been a good way to stop that sort of political interference. So it's going to affect it in so many different ways.
Tim Britton, you had referenced the note of caution that seems to pervade everything that is happening here in Britain. I look at it from the outside and I wander through London and things look pretty much the same as ever. But is that caution in the boardrooms and the research facilities and the universities? Give us a sense of the scale and what that could mean in the future.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there's an element of uncertainty. There just is. The fact that we're here talking about it, and I think the point's been just well made, that so much time is just wasted on this. And I do think one of the issues here is that there's all of this energy that's going into it, if put in a more kind of creative or productive direction, could probably be spent more usefully. But I also think that sometimes I think we can overplay it a little bit, because I think when you're talking about, if you're talking to global organisations with global concerns, actually what's going on in China at the moment or the research policies that are happening in North America are far more important than what's going on in the UK, quite frankly. So I think we can overplay it a bit, but I do think the point around the amount of energy that is focused on this and the time that sucks it in, and people just holding on because they're not sure. Because at the end of the day, once we know what we're faced with, as so many people have said, we'll get on and deal with it. Whatever it is, we will get on and work out a way, and in the medium to long term, it'll be fine. It'll be all right, because we'll work out how to make it okay. But at the moment, people are just holding back. I think, however, one thing might be an upside from that is actually the enormous amount of effort that's going into government at the moment solely focused on Brexit. I do think there's a really interesting political or sociological study to come out in the next 10 or 20 years that shows a possible upside for them not reorganising the NHS again or getting on with something and they're just leaving well alone and everyone is kind of getting on with their day jobs. So, you know, there might be some upside with our government not governing.
And Hugh Logue, I think you feel that you want to see a decision made, whatever that decision comes to be.
Yes, I think it's everybody at this stage, you know, even the most hardened Remainers want the next stage to happen. This, you know, the worst thing that could happen is somehow we extend it by another 2 years or something, and we drift for another 2 years. That will be damaging to publishing, indeed, damaging to most industries, except perhaps the alcohol industry, because they do very well. But yes, I think what everyone that speaks to me is wanting some outcome at this point, whether it's Theresa May's deal, or it's another referendum, or it's not to leave at all. But you know, the idea of negotiating now for it's likely that we're going to see an extension by another 3 months, perhaps in the next couple of days, but I think anything beyond that would just be unconscionable.
So Simon Ross, whether you're for Remain or for Leave, you're for something. You want something to happen?
Yes, I think everyone well, people don't like uncertainty. Even if they don't like the outcome, they will like the certainty of knowing what is going to happen. So I think the uncertainty is disruptive. I think it increases the negative image that people have of the UK, doing business with the UK, coming to study in the UK, doing research in the UK. And the longer that goes on, I think the more negative the image of just doing anything in the UK. So I can see it filtering down to, you know, the diversity of our author base. So do I really want to publish now with a UK university press? Mm. Why don't I just go and publish with a European one? Or better still, an American one? I see that there are lots of downside to the delay. Unfortunately, I do think there will just be that. It will be a delay. There won't be a decision in a sense that we know which way we're going. I think it'll just be a further delay. Although we were talking earlier on that MEPs are coming up for re-election in July, I think, which might focus a lot of people's minds. So maybe it won't be such a long delay.
Right. And the Manchester Press is one that focuses on arts, humanities, and social sciences. Is there opportunity in Brexit titles for you? I know you have a book just recently published by Aaron Davis, Reckless Opportunists, Elites, and the End of the Establishment. That's a pretty high-charged title.
We publish what we call crossover books, so academically based research, which is translated for a wider market. And there are always opportunities for publishing. I mean, Brexit is a little bit over-published because nobody knows what the outcome will be at the moment. As soon as there's a decision, there will be a whole raft of future Brexit titles. But any political controversy of the day is a publishing opportunity.
But there is a publishing opportunity for someone you know well, Hugh Logue. I understand your wife, Catherine, has a book coming out. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. Well, my wife, she's originally did a degree in linguistics, but she went on to become a lawyer. And then when she saw this Brexit thing, she's fascinated with language and she's fascinated with play on words. And she thought, well, you know what? If we're going to take back control, if we're going to take back our borders, well, we're going to take back our language as well. So let's get rid of all this foreign language, and I'm going to write the post-Brexit English dictionary. And she's gone through all the foreign language in the dictionary and rewritten it. So things like c'est la vie have become like it or lump it. And oranges, which are a bit European and a bit Spanish, well, you know, they're now British apples, and we're going to know by them as apples from now on.
No more croissants.
No more croissants. We'll have, I don't know, Greg's ice bun or whatever. So she's just having a bit of a laugh with that and has written a little joke book for...
Well, it sounds like fun. And, you know, here's my own take on the possible upside. Many smaller countries across Europe have seen population growth rates decline over recent years, and that trend may be about to reverse as thousands of Britons now claim citizenship in many EU member states. The Italians, the Irish, the Dutch, and others are about to discover they have family they never even knew about. With that, I want to say thank you very much for joining us today and to thank our panel, Tim Britton, Hugh Logue, Petra Labriga, and Simon Ross. Thank you all very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.